Britain is in shock after the election of Donald Trump. Hear what British people have got to say about it in a bit. I'm Graham Mack, and this is London Calling. Also on the way is the second part of my chat with Eddie the Eagle. You might have seen the film which tells the amazing story of how he got to compete in the 1988 Winter Olympics in Calgary. In part one of my chat, you heard Eddie tell the true story of what really happened. This week, he talks about how his life changed after the Games, how he was declared bankrupt, how he hasn't even kept the money he got from the film, and now lives in a house with no walls and no ceilings.
I'm still living off egg sandwiches. I still love my egg sandwiches because I haven't got a kitchen. So I've got a little camper stove and I'm able to boil water. So I have water for a kettle, for a cup of tea, and I boil water for some boiled eggs and that kind of thing.
Eddie the Eagle coming up later. Now back to the British reaction to the election of Donald Trump. Politically in Britain, it's been a story of snubs and U-turns. After he became president, Donald called world leaders on the phone to tell them he was looking forward to working with them. Britain's got a special relationship with the USA, so the British Prime Minister, Theresa May, was hoping to be one of the first people to get a call. She was 10th. Egypt, Ireland, Mexico, Israel, Turkey, India, Japan, Australia, and South Korea all got a call before Britain. Then the biggest snub to the British government came when the first foreign politician that Trump met was the interim leader of the UK Independence Party, Nigel Farage. Farage went to New York on Sunday and met Donald Trump at Trump Tower. Now, Nigel Farage isn't even a member of the British Parliament. The UK Independence Party, known as UKIP, is a Eurosceptic right-wing populist party. Farage is their interim leader. He's quit twice as leader this year, once after the general election in May and again after the Brexit vote in June. He's only the interim leader now because the party's in such disarray they can't find a leader. His replacement quit last month. Out of 650 seats in the UK House of Commons, UKIP only has one seat. And that bloke, Douglas Carswell, held the seat as a member of the Conservative Party till he switched sides. Trump, meeting with a political minnow like Nigel Farage before he meets with anyone from the UK government, has not gone down well at number 10 Downing Street. The bloke in the British government that should end up working the closest with Trump is our Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson. You may have seen Boris on TV. He's the bumbling, eccentric former mayor of London with a shock of unruly blonde hair that looks like a haystack in a gale. When Boris and Donald do eventually meet, the first question either of them should ask the other is, "Who's your barber?" Boris has sent Donald Trump a message congratulating him on his election win, and he's told him he's looking forward to working with him. He's also expressed his frustration with the people who aren't happy about the prospect of President Trump.
I think it's time we snapped out of the general doom and gloom about the result of this election and the collective whingerama that seems to be going on in some places.
But less than a year ago, when Donald Trump said he wanted to ban Muslims from entering America and that London had no-go zones that police were scared to enter because they were overrun by Muslims, this is what Boris said about Donald Trump then.
I think Donald Trump is clearly out of his mind. If you think that's a sensible way to proceed, you can't ban people going to the United States in that way, or indeed to any country. And what he's doing is playing the game of the terrorists and those who seek to divide us. That is exactly the kind of reaction they hope to produce. And I have to say, when Donald Trump says that there are parts of London that are no-go areas, I think he's betraying a quite stupefying ignorance that makes him frankly unfit to hold the office of President of the United States. I would invite him to come and see the whole of London and take him round the city, except that I wouldn't want to expose Londoners to any unnecessary risk of meeting Donald Trump.
So quite the U-turn there from our Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson. What's Boris's opinion on Brexit or Trump today? I've no idea. His mind changes like the weather. Maybe it's affected by the British weather. Just like his hair. So what do British people think about Donald Trump as president? How are you feeling, Ian?
I'm scared. I struggle that the guy is even sane. He's, you know, he seems to have shot himself in the foot so many times, and yet people still go back to him.
Well, he's promising them hope, you see. The people who've lost their jobs in, manufacturing and industrial areas, blue-collar people, they're believing what he says when he says he can bring the jobs back by, you know, curbing the immigration and by being less global as a nation.
So are they believing the bits where he says about the appropriate weight or the way that you're allowed to treat women?
It's strange, that, isn't it? Because they're kind of saying, oh,
it's way beyond strange.
Yes.
It's scary, you know. I'm stunned.
What's your biggest fear, then? What do you think he could do?
I'm not sure I even want to contemplate it. I just don't know. I have lots of ex-work colleagues in the States, and I seriously fear for what's going to happen next.
What do you think about this, Paul?
I think the American people had quite a poor choice, to be honest with you.
You see, they think we made a poor decision over Brexit.
I think we were possibly not told everything about Brexit before we went to the polls. But I think the Americans, speaking about Donald Trump, I think the Americans were offered a choice of a dog poo sandwich and a cat poo sandwich. You don't want either.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's also got the Republicans who control both sides of the House in America.
Yeah.
Which, you know, could mean that they could push through things that, you know, they try to get through in the past, won't get through. It's like the sort of Obama's, healthcare program, you know, giving people, poor people, a chance of good health.
Well, he's talking about repealing that, isn't he?
Absolutely, yeah. And that's not great news for the poor people.
No.
You know, I mean, we're lucky in our country. We get our Medicare, you know, we get our services for free. I know we pay for it in tax, but no one pays when they go to hospital,
Yeah.
But that means a lot of people are going to be without basic healthcare. That's not a good thing. That's not fair. That's third world type stuff.
Well, here's a disgraceful statistic about America as it stands now. The number one cause of bankruptcy in America is not being able to pay your medical bills, which for a modern society is a disgraceful statistic to have associated.
It is, absolutely. I mean, they talk about all the good things that they, I mean, God almighty, yeah, right? They think nothing of spending $4, $5, $6 billion on bombing a country, you know, for a couple of days.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they won't, but they're not prepared to help their needed out with some free healthcare. It's shocking.
Juliet, you're a little bit worried about President Trump?
I'm just worried because he's come across to me, or the impression that I've got is just that he's quite homophobic and racist, and that's just what worries me. I've always seen America as being a country where, you know, anybody has an equal chance, at least in some parts of it. And I don't know, I'm just worried that that might change. I'm not a supporter.
How do you feel, Ken?
Well, philosophical, really. Democracy's got to be seen to be done. He's won, so let him get on with it.
So you agree with democracy? See, I'm going right off democracy. I don't think it works. I think it empowers anarchists and lynch mobs. I think we need a better system. I think, like, if you had a lottery system for who gets to lead, they would have got a better result than this. A lot of people are saying defending democracy. Democracy gave us Adolf Hitler. I don't think democracy's got a great track record.
Well, I think Adolf Hitler was the wrong person at the wrong place at the right time.
You don't think that about Trump?
I don't know. I mean, don't forget they've had Democrats in power for two sessions, so there's generally a rebellion.
Yeah, but he's got lower unemployment than the Republicans had, than George W. Bush had, just as one measure of it, and that was one of the things that they voted for. But they think Trump will bring jobs back.
Well, they've got 100 million people unemployed in America.
Don't think it's not 100 million.
A third of the population, working population, is a lot of people.
It's not 100 million. Let me. Where did you get that figure from, Ken?
I just get don't know, I just heard that there's a third of the population out of work.
Well,
the population is 320 million.
Yeah, but a lot of them are retired, and a lot of them will be under the age of working. You're nowhere near.
Okay.
And
well.
that's been the problem. The lack of facts and the belief in BS is what's got Trump elected, and it's what's got us going out of Europe and causing Brexit. People are not checking. We've got the internet. You've got the facts at your fingertips these days, and people would rather believe the bull. Donald Trump, 45th President of the United States of America. How do you feel about that? Bonzi?
God help us.
Wow.
I don't know what's going to happen now, mate.
Our best hope is to see if the world can survive for 4 years, because within that time he'll get found out. He's a con man, and he was promising stuff he cannot deliver. When people in 4 years' time realise they're still broke, they're still out of work, the steel industry or the coal mining or whatever industry they're in hasn't come back, the manufacturing isn't going to come back, you know, the big corporations are still in charge. You're still owned by Facebook and Google and Walmart and all them. Nothing's changed. Because he can't change that.
No. There's everything else.
Once he gets found out, and 4 years should be plenty long enough.
You reckon it'll last 4 years?
Well, unless he does something to get him impeached, he will. Yeah.
Well, no, unless someone, you know, they've got guns over there, you know.
Oh, you think someone will bump him off?
I reckon that's already an end.
You think Donald Trump will be assassinated?
I think, yes.
How do you feel about President Trump? Sam?
I feel very sick. I just think it's all wrong. He's never been in politics. He makes crude remarks. He's sexist, fascist, bigger, homophobic, racist. And then he tries to backtrack and say, no, I didn't say that. Who wants him as a role model? Oh, dear God, this man has got his finger on the red button. And it's dangerous.
Let's hope we're all going to be all right. If you're looking for a bit of hope, it's in episode 1 of London Calling when I was talking to John Cleese about the prospect of a Trump presidency. And he said you just have to think about Lyndon Johnson, who was a pretty horrible human being. But he was a pretty good president. He got the Civil Rights Act through, passed a law in 64 to give those who ain't got a little more. Now back to my chat with Eddie the Eagle. In part 1, you heard his amazing story, what he had to go through to qualify to compete as a ski jumper in the 1988 Winter Olympics in Calgary. You heard how he had to borrow equipment and along the way had to sneak into hotels, sleep in his van and even a mental hospital. And how he'd eat food out of bins. I asked him what it felt like after all that when Eddie the Eagle Edwards made it to the Winter Olympic Games.
Oh, it was a dream of mine since I was about 8 years old to go to an Olympic Games. I didn't know that I was going to do it ski jumping. That was just the way it turned out. But, you know, it was a dream come true. And when I sat, you know, the opening ceremonies and they brought in the Olympic torch and it went around the track and then up the steps and it lit the Olympic flame. And I thought, oh my God, this is it. I'm here. I'm at the Olympic Games. It's incredible. What a feeling. And then I became Eddie the Eagle as well, which was a bonus. You know, just the whole thing about getting to the Olympic Games was just incredible. And even if I hadn't have become Eddie the Eagle and just been another athlete taking part at Calgary, I still would have been very, very proud. And, you know, I would have always remembered that for the rest of my life. As it happened, I became Eddie the Eagle and got a lot of attention, which I didn't go looking for it. It just kind of was thrust upon me. But, you know, I'm very glad that it has. You know, I'm very glad that I had the impact that I had.
And it had been a struggle up until that point. But right just before the Olympics, you ran out of money again during training.
I got some flight tickets from Virgin to go over to New York to do my ski jumping, which was wonderful, and I kept using those. Because I was part of the Olympic team and going to Calgary, the Olympic Association paid for my flight, but I went to Steamboat Springs first, and then from Steamboat Springs in Colorado, then on to Calgary. But they paid for my flight to go from London to Steamboat Springs, but didn't think about paying for my flight to go from Steamboat Springs to Calgary. And I had to get a job in Steamboat Springs in a hotel, washing up, scrubbing floors, waiting tables, to save up the $268 to get me to Calgary. I managed to do it. And yeah, it was a real struggle. I ran out of money, you know, quite a few times. So it was very, very difficult. And I was about £7,000 or £8,000 in debt by the time I went to the Calgary Olympics.
But as soon as you got there, you were given money straight away by the Eddie the Eagle Appreciation Society.
Yes, I was. I'd done a news item for the 9 o'clock news, and I said, you know, I'm Eddie Edwards, I'm Britain's first jumper, I'm going to the Calgary Olympics, and I've got no money, no sponsorship, but I got there anyway. And they got such a response. People were sending money to the BBC saying, here's £10 for Eddie to help him on his way to Calgary. And they sent that news item over to Calgary because it was an Olympic story, and they showed it on Canadian television. And then a group of supporters from an oil company in Calgary gave me this nickname, Eddie the Eagle, and then that was it. I got, you know, a huge contingency there, gave me some money to help me there and help me with my training and all that kind of thing. And the response from people was just incredible. And to this day, they've been absolutely wonderful 28 years later.
Why is it, do you think, then, so many people around the world were willing you on?
I think it was because I was exemplifying that Olympic spirit. I was this tiny David of a country against these Goliath nations of ski jumping. And I came from Great Britain. I had no money, no training facilities, no ski jumps, no snow, no trainers, no equipment, nothing. And yet here I was competing against these great big nations of ski jumping. And people thought, wow, this is what the Olympics should be all about. And I was exemplifying that Olympic spirit. And it was a very, very powerful message. And also the fact that I was always laughing and joking and having fun. I didn't let my difficulties with no money and no sponsorship pull me down. I was still happy to be there and doing the very best I could with what I had. And people thought, wow, yes, he's got such a lovely spirit. And I think that combination, and also as a dream of mine to get to those Olympic Games, you know, it was a very, very powerful message. And people really took me to their hearts and helped me as much as they could. And, you know, I thank my lucky stars they did, even now, 28 years later.
Do you ever worry that you might have been getting attention because some people wanted to watch you seriously injure yourself?
Oh, yes. Although there was a lot of people who wanted to watch me at ski jumping at the Calgary Olympics, I expect half of them were waiting to see whether I was going to fall and land on my head and break my neck. And they thought, oh, this is going to be good. This is going to turn into a video nasty. But it didn't happen. You know, I did 71 metres. It was a new British record. And, you know, I flew through the air and it was wonderful. And I think the 89,500 people in the stadium, you know, literally willed me on. And I must have jumped an extra 10 metres just for them.
And every jump you landed on your feet?
Every jump I landed on my feet, yep. So I was very, very lucky. They were very worried at Calgary because it was a very windy city, and they were a bit worried that they might not have the competition because it was too windy. They were getting worried about letting me jump because they said it was very, very dangerous for me with all that wind. But we had one day during the Olympic Games where it was beautiful blue sky and there was no wind, and they just made the immediate decision, we're going to have the competition. And so with literally an hour's notice, we jumped in the car, we drove straight to the jumps, and then the competition was going ahead. And I don't know how they managed to alert everybody at such short notice, and the competition went ahead, and it was incredible.
When you stood at the top of the ski jump waiting to set off, and there's nearly 90,000 people in the crowd there, are you aware that there's that amount of people watching?
Oh, yes. You know, when I'm standing at the bar, even when I'm just standing at the top waiting to go, I could see almost every one of those 90,000 people. And then getting towards my number, and it was my turn to go, the whole crowd started shouting, Eddie, Eddie. So they were kind of willing me on and willing me to go down. And, you know, I hadn't done a jump on a 120-meter ski jump for such a long time, and I was very, very nervous. But having that crowd, you know, willing me on was wonderful. You know, I was determined to jump as far as I possibly could for them. And I did. I got a new British record, which was incredible. It was lovely. And I was just very pleased, A, to get a new British record, and B, to land on my feet.
And is it true you competed in borrowed gear?
Yes, I did. Well, when I went to Calgary, my bindings were broken. So somebody lent me their skis with the bindings, and I went on from there. So, yeah, even at the Calgary Olympics, I was using borrowed equipment.
You had so many setbacks along the way. How close did you get to giving up completely?
Well, not too bad, actually. It was always a struggle doing my ski jumping. You know, when I first started, I found a few skis and boots and things like that in the shed at Lake Placid, and I used that. And then as I went along, at different jumps that I went to and I met different teams, people would see the equipment that I was using, and they'd say, oh, that's rubbish, here, have these. And they'd give me a pair of skis or a helmet or a pair of goggles or a new ski jumping suit. So lots of different people from lots of different countries, you know, were chipping in with equipment, and that's how I managed to do it, because there's no way that I could afford, you know, to pay for this equipment.
What kept you going? What made you so determined to keep going when you just kept getting knocked back?
It was just the sport. You know, I'm just as excited to put a pair of skis on now as when I first started, when I was 13 years old. I mean, that's 39 years. And I'm still excited to put skis on. That's what drove me on, really. If I was sleeping in the car, for instance, I didn't have to sleep in the car. I could have come home and you know, earned some money and got back out there. But if I slept in the car, that meant I could stay out there for another month. And to me, that was another 4,000 jumps. And that, to me, was very, very important, because I wanted to try and get to the Olympic Games. And so, you know, all these things, all these setbacks, it didn't really matter, because I was out there and I was doing what I wanted to do, which was ski and ski jump. And that was the most important thing. And if that meant scraping food out of bins and sleeping in the car and sleeping in a mental hospital and all that kind of thing, then so be it. I was just doing something that I loved doing. And if it meant doing that, then I would happily do it.
Your glasses would steam up under your goggles. Did you ever consider contact lenses?
I tried contact lenses. I tried the old ones, because I had such a bad astigmatism. I tried the gas permeable lenses, but it was like having grit in your eye, so I really couldn't get on with those. So I had to stick with wearing glasses. And I had lots of different people come up to me and giving me advice on how to stop the glasses steaming up, but nothing ever worked. And so, you know, the very last thing I would do when I went down the jump was bring my goggles down, because the moment I did that, my glasses would steam up. But I would leave the bar and start coming down the jump, and then as I pick up speed, the air would usually flow through my goggles and clear my glasses. But about 3 or 4 jumps in every 10, they didn't. And I was taking off, and I couldn't even tell which way up I was. I couldn't tell where the landing hill was. And sometimes I managed to stick a finger up through my goggles and wipe, and just enough to make me see where I was going and where I was landing. So it was, you know, it was very difficult at times, but, you know, there was nothing else I could do. I did find it easier if I went to the top of the jumps early. And if I went up there early and then waited for my body heat and my body to calm down, the less heat that I was allowing to escape out of my suit, then the less chance my glasses would steam up. So if I got up there nice and early, I'd be okay. But, you know, sometimes I just wasn't able to do that, and I just had to, you know, put them on and hope for the best, and hope that when I get to the takeoff, you know, my goggles would have cleared and my glasses would be clear and I could see where I was going.
Well, you came 58th in the Olympics? I don't want to say last.
That's right, yes.
When you came back, you were treated like a medal winner.
Yeah, I had a hero's welcome when I flew back, and, you know, it's been really like that ever since, and for the last 28 years. You know, people still come up to me even now and say, we loved you, what happened at Calgary, and of course, the film, you know, has brought it all back very, very vividly again.
Would you rather have won a medal and then go on to be virtually unknown?
I don't know, actually. I think I probably would have, actually. I would have loved to have won a medal, but my, you know, limitations, unfortunately, because I'd only been jumping for 20 months when I went to Calgary, and everybody else there had been jumping for 20 years. So there was no way that I was going to beat anybody, but for me, just getting there was my gold medal. But I think, given the choice, I think, yes, I would love to have won a gold medal, and if that meant just going back to plastering for the rest of my life, then so be it. But I was still very, very pleased with what I did and the way I did it, and I'm really pleased with the reaction that I've had from the people. people, and that it didn't really matter that you don't win. I think, you know, if as long as you get out there and you do your best, I think that's the most important thing. And that's what I always tell people, that, you know, as long as you get out there and do your best, that's all that people can expect of you. And, you know, you'll be respected for it. So, yeah, I think I think that's a nice way to live.
Let's talk about how your life changed after the 1988 Winter Olympics. Your fame opened a few doors, didn't it?
It did, yes. I travelled all over the world, opening shopping centres and golf courses and fun rides and all that kind of thing, having a whale of a time.
And what about money?
I went from a plasterer earning about £6,000 a year to Eddie the Eagle earning £10,000 an hour.
But 4 years after the Olympics, you declared bankrupt. What happened?
Well, all my money that I was earning was going into a trust because I was still an amateur sportsman. And in the Olympics, you had to be amateur to go into the Olympics. And so all the money that I was earning was going into a trust. And I had three trustees there to look after my money. And unfortunately, through alleged mismanagement and, you know, negligence, they lost a lot of my money. I had to go into bankruptcy. And, you know, I was allowed to, you know, take my trustees to court. And I got some of my money back at the end of the day. And I managed to buy a property. So, yeah, it was tough times. That was in 1991, 92, I think, somewhere around there.
And you went back to school as well. You studied law at De Montfort University in Leicester.
That's right. And that was because of my legal team and the way they put my case together. It was really, really interesting. So after I tried to go for the 1998 Olympics in Nagano, hadn't qualified. So I came home and went back to studying. I did some GCSEs through distance learning. Then I did an A-level through distance learning. And then I decided to go to De Montfort University in Leicester and study law. And it was all because of my bankruptcy and what happened there. And I loved it. I loved being a student. I loved studying law. It was a great 3 years of my life. And, you know, I still think now maybe I'll do another degree, but I did it just before they started charging for degrees. And nowadays, I think being 18 or 27, 30,000 pounds in debt at the end of a degree is kind of putting me off a little bit.
And Eddie the Eagle, the film, was a huge worldwide hit. You must have made some money out of that, didn't you?
I did, yes. Well, I signed the deal to make this film 17 years ago. It's been a long time coming. It was only because I did Splash and I won the first series of Splash that Dexter Fletcher saw me in Splash in the final.
And that was, for anyone that doesn't know, that was a reality TV show where celebrities, they dive.
That's right. Yeah, they were teaching celebrities to dive, springboard dive. I won the series and Dexter saw me. He was the director in the film, thought there's a story there. Then he'd heard that I'd signed these rights to a movie 17 years previously. So he managed to get Matthew Vaughan to buy them and then they made the film. It was incredible. And yes, I did get quite a bit of money, but unfortunately that had to go in my divorce. So got it in one hand and then it was taken away in the other.
You talk about your divorce. The marriage didn't work out, but you met your wife while you were working as a radio presenter. Where you lowered yourself to work as a radio presenter. Where was that?
Just as I was starting my degree in 2000 in Leicester, the BBC local radio station asked me if I would be a guest DJ. I used to do a request programme on a Sunday morning. So every weekend, I used to come back to Gloucestershire to do a request programme on a Sunday morning for BBC Radio Gloucestershire. And then Monday to Friday, I'd be in Leicester doing my law degree. And then I met my wife, now my ex-wife, and we got married as soon as I finished my law degree. We went to Vegas and got married, had two little girls, and then unfortunately we got divorced about 2 years ago.
Well, this year, the Daily Mirror newspaper reported that Eddie the Eagle is living in a garden shed, surviving on egg sandwiches after being, and their quote is, wiped out by his wife. How much truth is there in that story?
There is quite a bit of truth in that story. The living in a shed bit is a little bit old because I was living in a shed up till about a year ago. But I'm not living in the shed at the moment. But I am living in the house that I've got, but it is in a serious state of disrepair. I'm slowly renovating the house. But luckily enough, I'm not in the house very much anyway, because I'm travelling a lot doing promotional work, so I don't have to live in it all the time. I've got no walls, no ceilings. I've only just put a bathroom in and things like that. I mean, it's comfortable enough, but it's one of those things I'm doing slowly over the next couple of years. And I hope to, you know, be in a lot better position, hopefully by the middle of next year, and get the house, you know, finished and living comfortably. So that part is slightly old news. I'm still living off egg sandwiches. I still love my egg sandwiches because I haven't got a kitchen. So I've got a little camper stove and I'm able to boil water. So I have water for a kettle, for a cup of tea, and I boil water for some boiled eggs and that kind of thing. But, you know, when I'm doing dinners and speaking at dinners, I'm eating good meals there anyway. So I don't mind when I'm home if I'm only living off egg sandwiches, because, you know, usually sometime in the week I'm going to do an after-dinner speech or a motivational talk and go to a dinner, and then I can eat, you know, proper food. It's a bit tough, but I'm, you know, living okay.
Sounds to me like you've beaten bigger odds, Eddie. I think you'll be
fine.
Well,
that's right. That's right. You know, when you've been living in a camper van and travelling around Europe and scraping food out of bins, you know, the way I'm living now is luxury compared to that. And because I've done that before, and, you know, I'm quite happy to do it again. It's what I know. It's what I love doing. I love being active and, you know, doing my building work. I come from a long line of builders and plasterers, and, you know, I prefer to put my money into that than put it into the stock market.
In 2012, we had the Summer Olympics in London. As a former Olympian, were you asked to get involved?
No, I wasn't. A charity put my name forward to be one of the torchbearers for the London Games. And that was lovely. And I was hoping to be picked. Unfortunately, I got a letter to say, no, thank you, we don't require your services on this occasion. And so I wasn't able to be a torchbearer for the London Olympics, which was, you know, a shame. I would have loved to have done it, but unfortunately it wasn't to be.
How let down did you feel about that?
Well, I was a little bit put out, because I would have loved to have done it, just purely because I was, you know, a very well-known Winter Olympian, or just an Olympian. And more importantly, you know, people remembered me not through winning gold medals, but just for taking part, which was exemplifying that whole Olympic ideal. So I thought that might be quite, you know, important message. But obviously not. But there were lots of very deserving people who did the torch bearing. So I'm very happy that they did it. But it would have been nice to do it myself.
In soccer, you support Liverpool, which is the same as me, and is also handy, because if you supported Manchester United, I don't think I'd be able to talk to you. Do you get to many games these days?
I haven't been to a Liverpool match for years. I think the last Liverpool match I went to was about 10, 15 years ago. It was a local derby, Liverpool against Everton. Liverpool won 2-1, and it was great. And I still remember very fondly when I left school, you know, during my school term, when I was really into Liverpool. And that was the good old days with Phil Neal and Kenny Dalglish, yeah. and Phil Thompson and all
Alan
that.
Alan Hansen, yeah.
Yeah, that was brilliant. I mean, I do support Liverpool now. You know, I kind of support them from afar. You know, I still, you know, every week I look, where's Liverpool? How are they doing? And they're doing very, very well at the moment. They've got a new manager, and he seems to be doing some really, really good things with Liverpool. And, you know, they're right up there. They're in with a chance. I will keep my fingers, legs and skis crossed that at the end of the Premiership, next sort of April, May time, that we'll be up there and winning our first Premiership.
I think this is the season.
It could be.
What's next for Eddie the Eagle?
Well, I've got lots of things in the pipeline. There's a possibility of a new book that I'm going to write that will not only have all the hardship and the fight and the struggle at Calgary and all the funny stories that how I got there, but what happened afterwards and bring it all up to date. I'm doing a theatre tour next year, a couple of documentaries, and just busy, you know, doing my building work on my house and making sure I see as much of my two little girls as I can. They're not so little anymore. They're 9 and 12 now. And doing things like that, really. Just having, you know, enjoying life as much as I possibly can.
There could be a sequel to the film, maybe? There should be, because you had so much going on after the Olympics. There's another film there, surely.
Well, absolutely. I will have a word with Dexter and Matthew Vaughan, because they have left it open for a sequel. So I'll sit down with them over the next couple of months. I'll find out how well the film's done, because the film is yet to be released in Japan. I think it's released at the end of this month in Japan. So I'm still waiting to find out whether I've got to go to Tokyo to promote the film there and see if there's a possibility of a sequel. You never know. We might do it all again in another few years' time.
Eddie the Eagle, thank you so much for talking to me. You're a true inspiration. Your positivity is something I think everybody needs to take on board. I don't know how you've kept smiling on through all the challenges you've had, but just brilliant. I wish you all the success in the future, and I hope that the home renovations go well. Eddie the Eagle, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Eddie the Eagle. Next week, my guest is Susie Quattro. She's a rock chick who inspired other ladies of rock, including Joan Jett and Chrissie Hynde. She was born in Detroit and moved to Britain in the early 70s. She's had hits on both sides of the Atlantic and featured in 15 episodes of the sitcom Happy Days. Now, this was an interview that nearly didn't happen. Susie invited me to her rockstar mansion in Essex, which is about an hour out of London. I allowed plenty of time to drive there and planned to stop for lunch on the way. I followed my sat-nav, and about halfway there, I found a Burger King in the middle of nowhere. I stopped, I had something to eat, I set off again, and then about 5 miles shy of Susie's place, I noticed that my bag wasn't on the passenger seat. This bag contained my MacBook and my Yeti microphone that I was going to use to record the interview. I'd left my bag in the Burger King. Now, I don't know that area of Essex at all. I was following the sat-nav. So I turned around and tried to retrace my steps and got lost. At that point, I called my wife, Julie, hoping that she could go on Google Maps, work out the way that maybe I should have gone and she could find this mythical Burger King that I couldn't re-find. When I called her, she said, "Are you lost?" I said, "No, worse." And at that point, she thought I'd had an accident. So she's freaking out. I'm freaking out. I'm thinking, I've lost my MacBook. I've lost my Yeti microphone. I've lost this interview. And just then, I saw a plane in the sky. It was landing at London Stansted Airport. And I remembered when I was in this Burger King, I looked out the window and I saw planes landing at Stansted, only they were on the other side. So I knew if I got to the other side of this flight path, at least I'd be kind of in the right area. So I headed that way. Things started to look familiar. And eventually, I tracked down this Burger King. And I raced in. And now time's running out. I've got to get to Susie Quattro's house. I raced in and someone had handed my bag in, which is incredible. First of all, it's like £1,000 worth of equipment in that bag. But even more than that, this Yeti microphone, it looks like a bomb. It's shaped like a bomb. It has wires that come out of it like a bomb. There's a laptop computer in there. And this is a Burger King in the flight path for planes landing at Stansted Airport. Really, the whole place should have been cordoned off. But anyway, I grab the bag, I head back into the car, I reprogram the sat-nav, I'm following that, and the sat-nav's on my phone. I've got it in a clamp that's stuck in an air vent on the dashboard. Anyway, that falls off. I pick it up, and because I've touched it, it's now not following me on the map. So I'm having to scroll with my finger to keep myself on the map. Time's running out. I'm stuck behind the slowest truck I've ever been stuck behind in my life. Follow the sat-nav down a dead end. So now I've got to phone Susie Quattro and tell her I'm lost. I called her up. She couldn't help. Did a U-turn. Eventually found the right road. Got to Susie Quattro's house. Bang on time. But by the time I got there, I mean, I do a breakfast show on the radio. I'd been up since 4 a.m. This is 3 in the afternoon. And in between, I've done a 3-hour radio show. I've spent another 3 hours recording phone interviews at the radio station to use for the rest of the week. I'd been on the road for 2 hours. I'd lost and found my MacBook and my microphone. I'd got lost. I'd gone down a dead end. I'd scared my wife into thinking I'd had an accident. When I got to Susie Quattro's house, I was ready to collapse. As it turned out, Susie was great. She had some brilliant stories to tell, including one about when she started out and she's in an all-girl group, and they got to work with a legend of rock and roll.
We were in Buffalo, New York, and we were supporting Chuck Berry. He was on after us. And one of the girls, long blonde hair and quite big-chested. And anyway, we were watching, and then we went back in the dressing room, and Chuck Berry came off the stage from his show. And he was only honestly fooling around. He was fooling around. He didn't mean anything. He grabbed the blonde, and he was playing and threw her on the couch messing around. And my dad happened to walk in at that point.
Yeah.
So he just went, wallop. I said, Dad, you just knocked out Chuck Berry.
Susie Quattro, next week on London Calling with Graham Mack. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mack. If you want to hear more Mac Nuggets, check out my website, macmedia.co.uk, and subscribe to my Bob FM show on iTunes. Got a question or something to say? Send me an email. Put your phone number in the email. I might call you back or Skype you on the show. My email address is graham@macmedia.co.uk. You spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next week. Ta-da.